this term, and it's particularly good writing about, who's come all the way from Edinburgh today, the University of Edinburgh. Esther's going to be speaking to us on Scottish women missionaries in an expanding empire, the shaping of Mary Slessor as a missionary icon. And we started thinking about what series we might have this year through Mary Slessor, rather because we remembered that it was the centenary of her death this year. And there have been a number of events that Esther and others have been involved in Edinburgh and Dundee and other places, thinking about her life. And Esther has written a book on the empire and Scottish society, The Impact of Foreign Missions at Home from 1790 to 1914. And she's also co-edited books on women and citizenship and Scottish women. And so I think that gives you some idea of how she might be approaching this subject. So thank you very much for coming, Esther, and over to you.
Thank you, Emma. It's very nice to be here. I hope people can hear me all right. If I start to mutter and mumble, just say so. I was asked earlier this year to do something about Mary Slessor, which has really got me on to thinking about locating her within in the foreign mission, the Presbyterian foreign mission movement. So I'm not a historian of Slessor as such, nor even of women missionaries, nor of churches, but rather someone who approaches from a secular perspective the history of Scottish participation in empire. But of course, among or part of that experience, one of the most significant dimensions was indeed Scottish foreign missions. But that's the perspective that is informing my discussion of Mary Slessor's location within the foreign mission movement and how we might understand what I'm calling the process of iconisation. Other people have gone so far as to say sanctification or a Protestant form of Marialatry even. And this just to indicate some of the visual ways in which she has been iconised. This was the two of the stained glass windows, the others will come later, that were erected in Dundee in 1923. And perhaps in passing I should mention I am a Dundonian. Mary herself wasn't born in Dundee, but lived and grew up there before becoming a missionary. So I'm not sure how familiar people are with biographies, so I'm going to give a very quick rattle through what you might call the key facts of her biography. Mary Slessor was born in Aberdeen in 1848. Her mother was a weaver and her father a shoemaker, who reputedly lost that employment because of his partiality to alcohol. The family moved to Dundee in 1859 and began to work in the jute industry, which was burgeoning, had been growing from the 1830s. Mary Slessor began working in a jute mill at the age of 11. She worked as a weaver until the age of 28, and she seems to have been the main breadwinner in her family, I think both before and after she went to Old Calabar in West Africa. She was a member of the United Presbyterian Church, and I'll say a little bit later about the denominations. She was a Sunday school teacher there and a worker in home missions in Dundee. She was accepted as a missionary by the United Presbyterian Church in 1875. She undertook training at Murray House in Edinburgh, which was the teacher training college it still is, it's part of Edinburgh University. She had a short training course there, and then she went to the Old Calabar Mission in what is now Nigeria in 1876. And as I say, I don't know, of course, people may well be familiar with some of the story and some of the Old Calabar story, so forgive me if I'm repeating things that people already know. After 12 years at Old Calabar, she moved inland. So in 1888, she moved inland a bit to establish a mission station at Ekenge in Okoyong. And she repeated the process of establishing new missions in the hinterland of Old Calabar several times subsequently, particularly after the expedition against the Arrow people in 1902. She carried out work of an educational and evangelical nature and took into her household twin children, whom she rescued from death, as according to local custom, twins were believed to be evil spirits. And I'll say a bit more about that later on as well. From 1892, she served the British colonial administration in presiding at local courts among African communities. And she didn't do this continuously until her death, but I think for much of the period until her death in 1915, she did. She was made an honorary associate of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem in 1913 on the recommendation of Frederick Lugard, then governor of Nigeria. And this was an honor that could be given to a commoner. I think she was the first British woman to be given it. It was by royal, gift of the king, obviously, but recommended by Lugard. She wasn't in a position where she could have got other colonial honours, which had begun to be developed, as David Cannadine has written about in ornamentalism, and indeed there were women getting other sorts of honours, but there's an issue here of class and status. But it was largely to do with her role as somebody who was caring for the sick as part of her missionary work. She died in Nigeria in January 1915. She was the subject of a biography by William Pringle Livingstone, no relation to David, I must say that because I will be mentioning David later as well as William Pringle, and that was published in 1916. The narrative and characterisation of Slessor's career given in the biography have been recycled over many decades in many ways. And the key tropes were as follows. The working class mill girl who rose to be a missionary. The pioneer missionary moving into new territory. The brave woman who stood up to African savagery and cruelty, obviously in quotes. The saviour of twin children. The dispenser of justice. The honoured colonial servant. Subsequently, both then and subsequently, claims made about Slessor's character and achievements range from the far-fetched to more faithful reflections of the historical record of the mission in Old Calabar. And during this year, as Emma has mentioned, the centenary of Slessor's death, her life has been commemorated anew in both Scotland and in Nigeria, a new memorial in Dundee at the beginning of the year, for example. And some of these commemorations have echoed earlier celebrations of her life, but others have sought to appropriate her anew for more modern causes, whether the contemporary civic pride of Dundee and its sort of working class heritage and tradition of women's employment, or modern feminism, the idea that she was a sort of forerunner of a humanitarian campaigner for women and children's rights. And my aim here is to place Slessor in the context of her times, to track the process of her iconisation and to ask what factors may have been influential in this. I'm going to start by giving a fairly brief overview of women and the Scottish Presbyterian Foreign Mission Movement, to establish really its duration and extent by 1915. So by the time that Slessor was fashioned into an iconic missionary figure, Scots women had been demonstrating their interest in foreign missions for around a century. The initial non-denominational societies, the Glasgow Missionary Society and the Scottish Missionary Society, set up in 1796, just after the London Missionary Society, were supported by a network of local branches and congregations. Ladies and female missionary societies existed by the 1820s, and women, I'm sure, would have been involved in fundraising for missions before this, although they didn't have their own organisations or auxiliaries. By the late 1830s, ladies' associations had been formed, and at this point, societies began employing single female agents. So the first one from the Scottish Presbyterian Church in 1838. However, wives of missionaries were already undertaking missionary work unpaid. Following the disruption of 1843, when a substantial proportion of ministers and members left the established Church of Scotland to form the Free Church of Scotland, and also following the formation in 1847 of the United Presbyterian Church through the unification of the Secession and Relief Churches, Scottish foreign mission operations came to be dominated by these three main Presbyterian denominations. There was other things going on as well, like the Edinburgh Medical Missionary Society, and also Scotland supplied quite a lot of London Missionary Society missionaries, such as Robert Moffat, and of course the best known, John Philip would be another one, but David Livingstone, of course. At the disruption, the ladies' societies reorganised themselves onto denominational lines, allied respectively to the Church of Scotland and Free Church of Scotland. In the 1880s, the women's societies' position within church structures became more formalised as commitment to women's missionary work was strengthened and more women were being recruited also as missionaries. The United Presbyterian Church, to which Mary Slessor belonged, didn't form what they called the Zenana Mission Committee of its Foreign Mission Board till 1881. And I mean, I do think that the title Zenana there is a bit of a paradox because they applied it across the board. From work in India, but it wasn't necessarily applicable to other countries where they had missions by that time, but that's what they called it, the Nana Mission Committee. And it was formed in 1881, but the United Presbyterian Church had already been employing women missionaries before that. In 1900, the United Presbyterian Church and the Free Church joined together to form the United Free Church, at which point they launched a series of books to publicise their missions. And as I mentioned, that unification was partly because I think it did up the ante, if you like, in promotion of missionary work. And as we will see when I talk about William Pringle Livingstone, a sort of more professionalisation, if you like, of its publicity. So I think that step of unification was also important in the wider publicisation of Mary Slessor as a female missionary. Networks of supporters at home grew over the decades, as did numbers of women putting themselves forward for missionary work. As I've already mentioned, although married women were unpaid, they were part of the missionary workforce from the start. Typically, male Scots Presbyterian missionaries were married, and indeed it was generally thought that a wife was a necessary helpmeet in the enterprise. Missionary wives like Margaret Wilson in Bombay from the late 1820s and several of Slessor's predecessors in Old Calabar from the 1840s were the real pioneers of women's missionary work in Scots missions. Their work was known at home and acted as an inspiration to others. Women's share of the missionary workforce increased from the 1880s. By 1900, taking paid single women and unpaid married women together, they were a majority of the missionary workforce of the main Presbyterian denominations, 66% of the Church of Scotland and 61% of the newly created United Free Churches. The feminisation of the Scottish Presbyterian missionary workforce was thus well underway by the turn of the century. And by then, single women predominated over the wives of missionaries, which hadn't been earlier. I couldn't say exactly when that transition would have happened, but by that time it certainly had. But the missionaries' wives of that era were also typically of similar professional backgrounds, often also qualified, whether as teachers, doctors, or nurses, and so on. The women's increasing interest in missionary work flowed both from religious conviction and from changing secular aspirations. Opportunities in teaching had expanded greatly for women following the 1872 Education Act, 1872 in Scotland, it was earlier in England. Access to higher education in the later decades of the 19th century brought women medical graduates to the missionary project too. Training also became more formalised. The Free Church set up a Women's Missionary Training Institute in 1894, and recruitment increasingly emphasised the need for qualifications. In 1917, the United Free Church Central Board stated its criteria for home and foreign mission workers, making it clear that women's foreign mission work, For women's foreign mission work, professionally qualified recruits were wanted. University graduates and certificated teachers, doctors and fully qualified nurses. Though they also had a general work category for which, and I quote, women with good home experience or business or other training might apply. And I think that was probably in order the management of things like boarding schools or industrial training, but kind of like matrons, you know, or training girls in domestic skills. But that's speculation because I'm not terribly sure. We need further research to see if who might have been in that category and what they actually did. This slide here is an indication of the literature that existed by mid-19th century. These two periodicals there, the Eastern Female's Friend is the Free Church publications, the News of Female Missions, the Church of Scotland, both one from 1859 and one from 1864. And I think the first specific women's periodical was an early, the Eastern Female's Friend. I was looking at your database, Terry, trying to remember exactly when it started, in the 1850s anyway. It was because it's hard to actually find copies of it. It's not like, I haven't been able to get a full run of them. Anyway, that's a, people want to talk about sources and periodicals, that can be for later discussion. But that's just to illustrate that that kind of literature was available from that period onwards. And women's missionary work was also covered in the main denominational periodicals. It wasn't exclusively covered in the women's periodicals, so you get a mix, but clearly these were for women readers. By 1900, the United Free Church's Women's Missionary Magazine was an important platform for publicising women's work, and it had a circulation of 28,000 in 1902. In addition, there were publications by and about Scottish women missionaries. Several had been the subject of biographies, sometimes together with their husbands, by the end of the 19th century. And just a couple of examples. There was a memoir of Margaret Wilson, who I mentioned earlier, Mrs. Sutherland, who I'll mention also later in the O'Calabar connection, and William and Louisa Anderson had all the biographies published about them. And Agnes Watt, who was a missionary in New Hebrides, now Vanuatu. This slide here indicates, this has been put together at a later date because they're called Church of Scotland mission fields. The time that we were talking about, of course, it wasn't Church of Scotland. Mostly it was United Presbyterian, Calabar Field was mostly United Presbyterian Church and then United Free Church. But after 1929, when they all reunified, they were then sort of incorporated as the Church of Scotland mission. So I'm not sure when this was created, but it's post-1929. But that just gives you a sense of the distribution of the mission fields in Africa in the 19th century. What I'd like to move on to, you know, having sort of given this sort of sketch of the development of the women's missionary movement, is to now talk about specifically the mission at Old Calabar. The United Presbyterian Church, at its formation, had missionaries in Jamaica and at Old Calabar, and later established stations in India, Manchuria and Japan, as well as funding Dr. Robert Laws, who was a leading missionary in the Livingstonia Mission in Nyasaland, as was Malawi now. The Old Calabar Mission was established in 1846. It emerged directly from the Jamaican experience of the Scottish Missionary Society missionaries. It was led by the Irish Presbyterian, the Reverend Hope Waddell, or Waddell, I'm not sure how you would have pronounced his surname. It was set up in response to a letter from King Iamba of Duketown, who requested men to teach reading and Christianity. It included Afro-Caribbean members, and recruitment from Jamaica remained part of the mission's practice throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, encompassing white, black and mixed race staff. And it's actually quite hard to work out in some of these cases who, you know, what the ethnicity of the staff was, because the names tended to be European or British names, effectively. So I think that's an intriguing aspect that would be worth researching more. The latter Jamaican staff included women. And the picture here of William and Louisa Anderson shows Louisa Anderson was born Louisa Peterswald in Jamaica, described as a woman of colour in Gerald Anderson's Biographical Dictionary of Christian Missions, so probably mixed race. And William Anderson, who came from the borders, met her. He was a catechist and then became ordained later. He met her in Jamaica. She was a teacher and he married her, and then they went to Old Calabar. He joined the mission in 1849. Another black Jamaican was Ma Fuller, later to dedicate herself to missionary work. She first came to Old Calabar with Reverend Dr. Robb and his family as a nurse, and she married an African from Sierra Leone, and after his death dedicated herself to missionary work, doing a lot of the things that was often said about Mary Slessor, looking after outcast children, twins, nursing the sick, and so on. Women then were active participants in the mission from its earliest days, and prior to Slessor's arrival in 1876, women conducting missionary work had included missionaries' wives, sisters and daughters, and paid single women. And I've been picking up as I've been looking at primary sources here that quite often you had family members who seemed to be supporting themselves or supported by the family. So I think there's a rather sort of invisible addition to the women's workforce that wasn't actually sponsored either by the churches or by ladies' societies, but were supported by their families. So I think that was true of some of the family members in Old Calabar. It must be said that most of the biographies of Slessor often refer to her predecessors, or some of her predecessors, most notably Louisa Anderson and Mrs. Sutherland, but mostly, but only in the passing. It was particularly with the abolition of twin murder that Slessor's name came to be associated. Indeed, as David Mbua has indicated, the claim that it was, and I quote, "it was the legendary Mary Slessor of Scotland who stopped the killing of twins in Calabar," end of quote, continues to be made in biographies and contemporary Nigerian educational texts. And this comes from an article, whether he's pointing out that actually a lot of work was done prior to her arrival. Missionary writings condemned the practice not only as barbaric but also superstition, and there seemed to be a range of beliefs that informed this idea of it being an evil that the children must be killed and the mother outcast. The belief that a spirit or devil was the father of the second child was one dimension of it, or that the second baby really belonged to another woman and had been stolen, or that the woman had been impregnated by two men and was therefore guilty of adultery. And also in anthropological writings, it's been said the idea that multiple births were associated with animals, the idea of it being to have more than one at a time, something that happened with animals and not with humans. So there seemed to be a number of things that came together to make twin births problematic. In this particular culture is that the people in Old Calabar were immediately engaging with. Missionary Hugh Goldie offered an economical explanation for the practice regarding the exposure of twins as a means of relieving parents of a too onerous burden of support, and therefore effectively being a means of population control. More recent anthropologically based understandings of attitudes towards twins suggest, however, that socioeconomic factors are of little importance in understanding twin killing, but rather that religious, spiritual, and epistemological systems are fundamental. Not only was the custom challenged by missionaries from the outset, but government assistance was enlisted from British consuls to change and enforce the law. And this is even from the 1850s, where they had some capacity to exert influence and power in coastal towns. The practice of rescuing twins also commenced early on, with the first instance occurring in 1851.